It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Hooray! Sorry for being late.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Welcome to the In Defense of Ska podcast.
There's a lot of like, okay, well, you like ska, name three bands that aren't the Boss Tones.
I'm your host, Aaron Carnes, music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska.
And I'm your co-host, Adam Davis, veteran ska musician from the bands Omnigon and Link 80.
On our show, we aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of ska music.
There are so many great untold stories throughout the history of ska. The show features interviews with everyone from the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones to Fishbone, Fall Out Boy singer Patrick Stump, and the Police drummer Stuart Copeland. Join us on In Defense of Ska from the Consequence Podcast Network.
And welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's the interview series presented by WFPK at WFPK.org, Consequence, and the Consequence Podcast Network. Thanks, as always, for making your way here and checking out the series. You know what to do. Like what you see, what you hear. Hit that subscribe button. I put out three new interviews every single week. New one every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. So it's a great way to keep up with your favorite artists and discover some new ones at iTunes and Apple Podcasts, at Spotify, Podchaser, NPR, WFPK.org, YouTube for the video versions, or anywhere you get your podcasts from. I'm Kyle Meredith. Today, my guest, David Rowntree. Going to be talking to the Blur drummer about his debut solo album, one that has songs that hit on keeping relationships alive as a touring musician, confirmed bias in pattern recognition, making friends with machines, and also how his work in film scores finds its way into the music. Now, of course, we're also going to discuss the upcoming Blur reunion, how that came together, and the potential for new music from the Britpop legends. All that and more, we're talking radio songs. It's Kyle Meredith with David Rowntree.
Hi, how you doing?
Congratulations on this, man. What a fantastic listen this has been.
Thank you. Thank you. That's very kind.
What a time for this to come out as well. And we're going to talk about a lot of things, I think, in this. But here we have the announcement that you've done your very first radio, your very first solo album. This comes after your stint in politics and right before there's a Blur reunion. How's things going right now? How are you feeling?
Well, these things always collide, no matter how much effort you put into spacing them out. They always collide with one another. And, the limiting factors really have been there's still a massive, great post-Brexit delay in pressing vinyl. And we thought long and hard about whether we should just go, well, whatever, you know, we'll release it. Release the vinyl later and it'll all sort itself out, or whether to wait and release everything together. And we decided to wait and release everything together back when there was a kind of 6-month delay. And then by the time we had all of our bits together, there was a 9-month delay. So, you know, this has been ready for a while and could, had we not taken that decision, could have been released quite a bit earlier. But the Blur thing, you know, we've just recently announced some big Blur shows. It didn't seem to me very likely that they were going to happen up until a couple of weeks before they were announced. It's very difficult to, again, post-Brexit and with the political situation, you know, Russia's, you know, inflation of oil prices and all of that, everything kind of, and with the pandemic, everything's kind of conspired to make it very, very difficult to put gigs on at the moment. So for one reason or another, it didn't seem to me it was very likely that that was going to happen. And all of a sudden, it was happening. You know, we announced it. But anyway, so the album's out in January and the tour doesn't start until, I think, probably June. will be the first gigs. I'm unlikely to be able to get, do anything before that. So it'll be a busy and interesting year.
Yeah, that's I'll jump ahead. You've got this song called A Thousand Miles on this new album, and it's a beautiful song. I feel like that's really starting to become more of a reality once again, what this song kind of sings about.
Yeah, it's about, you know, the difficulties really of keeping a relationship going from a distance, which a lot of people suffer from that problem, you know, not just musicians. It's about the particular instance of me leaving to write the song, actually leaving home to write the song with a friend of mine, Hogni, an Icelandic musician. And just on the way out the door, I've contrived to have an argument with my girlfriend, which is just awful, because it just means, you know, you don't get to resolve it until you come back home again. It was just terrible. It meant the whole writing session was kind of overshadowed by, you know, the sort of feeling in the pit of your stomach of, oh God, everything's, you know, God, what are we going to do? You know? So of course, inevitably the words were about that too, you know, it's actually worked out quite well. So make a point of having an argument on the way out of the door every time I go to write a song with somebody, the cleaner or, you know, my mother-in-law or anybody really, you, if you're available.
Just, always available. Well, I was going to ask if your lesson was learned, but maybe it was, just not the way that I was expecting it to be.
Yeah, even I am not usually stupid enough to have an argument on the way out of the door. That was a new low, even for me.
Well, let's see. So here we are. And again, you know, for all the things that you do in your life and you're what I guess would used to be called a Renaissance type of fella, with all your hand in different things, but to just do a solo album, I mean, you're an accomplished musician. When did you decide to? What is the journey to you going, all right, now it's time to do this?
I guess I've always been a songwriter. That's something that's always interested me. But what happened was, I suppose it takes a bit of self-confidence to think, I know what I'll do. I'll release a record on my own. That's the kind of, and you know, I've got so used to being the drummer in the band. You know, I didn't start out as being the drummer in the band, but you know, I'm so used to being in that role with Blur, really. I kind of didn't really have the self-confidence to do it, to sort of do anything with my songs. And it wasn't until I started writing film scores and TV scores some time ago, I don't know when that was, 7 or 8 years ago now, I suppose. And that really took off, and that gave me the kind of musical confidence again to think, actually, why don't I do something with these songs? But I would probably still, nothing would have happened were it not for COVID and the lockdowns, really, because, you know, my film career had taken off and I was pretty much busy all the time doing that. So it would have been another sort of half finished project, no doubt, among my millions of half finished projects. But the second lockdown in particular, the film industry had pretty much ground to a halt. You know, there were no films being made, no scores being written. And I'd got this recording studio in my house, sort of sitting there doing nothing. You know, I was sitting in it noodling, kind of frustrated. And my friend Leo, who we had resolved to do some work together, found himself in a similar position. And we thought, we had actually thought, well, let's put some time aside to start this record. And then, of course, the lockdown had happened and kiboshed that. So we were both stuck in our studios looking for something to keep us out of mischief. And we thought, all right, there's plenty of preparatory work you can do before you actually start recording, you know, putting sessions in order and kind of some editing and sort of, you know, converting played instrumental lines into MIDI so you can replay them through other instruments, all that kind of thing. We'll just start doing all of that. And 6 weeks later, the album was finished. You know, it turned out to be a ruthlessly efficient way of working. We're both kind of fluent in how studios work. So had I not been, it probably wouldn't have been as successful. But, you know, we were actually found, it was fairly obvious what needed to be done. We both understood the vision of where the thing was going. And, You know, it meant we could work at double speed, really. We divided up the tasks in the morning, you know, over our cups of coffee, and ploughed on throughout the day, swapped files backwards and forwards as we did them. And it all worked really, really well. So I'm not sure I would do it again. It was you get the ruthless efficiency, but you don't get the sitting in the same room, bouncing ideas off each other. But that's the kind of, that's the bit that I missed out of the whole process. So, but for the phases, and there are many in a project where work just needs to be done, you know, it's kind of, it's a really efficient way of doing it. So some kind of hybrid process on the next one, I think, would really work.
And we'll be right back right after this. Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith with David Rowntree.
It's interesting because it's almost like the romance is taken out of what we would traditionally think of songwriting, yet the romance is still in the songs. And I mean that in a broad sense, but even like, you know, hearing you talk about the film scores, I guess I'm not surprised when there are moments on here that really sound emblematic of that. HK is a great example. Even Downtown, those ethereal sounds is sort of happening in there. Is that just a natural thing for you, or did you see the two worlds? I mean, when you talk about, you know, knowing what the story and the vision of this record is going to be, how much of that is part of it?
Well, it's kind of inevitable, really. I think that was going to be a big influence on the sound of the record, not least because that's what my recording studio is all about. You know, it hasn't got a drum kit in, it hasn't got a bank of guitars, you know, it has a, it's basically got synthesizers in and percussion and a lot of interesting ways of making sounds. That's what you're looking for with film. You're not looking for a rock performance. You're looking for, you know, sensitivity, creativity, and you're looking for sounds that can convey emotion in an interesting way. And that's always the gig when you're writing film music. And so they're the instruments I have. That was always going to be a massive influence on the sound. But also, as I was writing the songs, which happened a couple of years before I started recording them, you know, when I was writing them, I was kind of, as you usually do, I was sort of figuring out as I was going along what it was I was trying to say and what it was I was trying to express, you know. And the radio songs idea came fairly early on in the process, because radio has been something that's influenced me in many ways, not listening to pop music on the radio, though that of course has been a big influence on me, but radio technology, and it's been a big influence on my life in many ways. But one thing that I've always thought was interesting was what goes on in between the stations. You know, there's static obviously in between the stations, but also there's lots of other sound that's there for lots of other reasons. And so I've been, as well as songwriting, I've been flicking through the dials, collecting this sound, you know, what I thought was the interesting parts of it. And I used that as the basis for several of the songs, for the kind of bed of them, you know, either actually just playing these sounds and seeing what other sounds worked with them, or cutting it up and using it as samples for various things, you know, sort of drum samples or all kinds of other stuff. So that was the other reason why the, you know, the other kind of, because it's not really a particular genre on this record, but there are threads behind, you know, threads that run through it. And I suppose that's the other thread, really, the sound in between the stations.
I mean, it almost works as like field recordings in a way. And I mean, and you know, some of these sounds you're talking about, like I hear whispering on certain parts. Is that samples, or do you have someone else? Because there's also a female voice occasionally throughout this.
Yeah, there's two tracks with female voices on. One is my co-writer Julia. She, it's a song about anxiety and kind of the voices in your head at 4 a.m. telling you you're an idiot and all your projects are going to fail. So, you know, I sang the part of the voices in the head telling you're an idiot, and she sang the part of, you know, the rational you saying, no, it's going to be fine, you know. So that was the kind of, that was tape measure, and that was what that song was about. The other one was, I found a, which was eight, was it HK? Yes, it was HK. I found a recording of a woman on the internet and in true 1960 style, I cut it all up and made a new story out of what it was she was saying. And then I got a singer friend of mine in to come in and recreate it. So I didn't, I didn't want to use somebody's voice without their permission. So I kind of recreated the sound of it. And yeah, it's a love song, really. But it's kind of the love song is sort of buried a bit. So I won't go into too much detail of what it actually means. But it's interesting when often it's the parameters within which you work, the limitations on within which you work that can make interesting art, I think. And cutting up somebody else's work and trying to make something new out of it is one of those things that is quite interesting. You can't add words, you can take them away and you can change the order of them, but the palette is the palette. What can you make out of that? That's often quite an interesting kind of starting point.
Well, it's a beautiful song. In HK's really one of my favorite moments on here. And hearing you talk about, some of the stories, I guess I find the story behind London Bridge, really interesting, because here's something that you've explained, you started seeing the same numbers in various places. And I know there's a word for that and I'm dropping it right now, but I start to think about the song seems, or maybe just you in the song seems like there would be a great conflict of the scientific part of you and what might be, for better lack of a term, the superstitious part of you, and how they kind of collide. What's going on there?
Yeah, you're right. It's kind of there are two times in my life where this has reared its ugly head. The first, when I was young, I just started seeing a particular number everywhere, and it was the number of a bus I used to catch. It was the number of the house I used to live at, and they're probably the two that put the idea in my head that kind of focused me on it. And then once I had the number in my head, I just started seeing it everywhere else. It'd be on a door number I was walking past, it'd be on the end of a phone number that I was dialing. I'd see it everywhere. And I knew what this was, a very famous psychological phenomenon that means when you have an idea, things that reinforce that idea are visible to you, and things that don't act against that idea are invisible to you. It's one of the most studied phenomena in psychology, really, and it's a kind of limitation that humans have because human brains are pattern recognizers, really, very, very good at it, but wildly oversensitive. And so they'd rather, because we're animals that whose main defensive mechanism is to run away rather than to turn and fight. That's what we're best at. And so we see patterns, we see the face of the lion in the bush in the dusk, even when it's not there. We'd rather do that than miss a lion. We'd rather run away from some illusory lions than miss a real lion and get eaten. The pattern recognizer in me was pinging over this number, and I knew that was what was going on. It didn't. The interesting thing for me, and when it happened the second time, I was living in London with London Bridge. I started seeing London Bridge there. There were kind of weird connections going on. When I was near London Bridge, things would happen. However, when an odd thing happened, I wasn't near London Bridge. My brain didn't go, "Hang on, that counts against your London Bridge theory, doesn't it?" Because that's not how brains work. And I knew with London Bridge that was what was going on. And the interesting thing was, knowing what was going on didn't make the effect any less powerful. It was still happening, even though I knew it was just an odd trick of my psychology, an odd trick of human psychology, So, and that knowledge that something's going on with your brain, knowing that something's going on with your brain is no help in stopping that happening, came in much later when I started to suffer from poor mental health, and I was aware that I was suffering from poor mental health, and that all came home to me then. Oh yeah, just knowing, as I found out with London Bridge and with the number when I was a kid, just knowing that, just being, even reading some self-help books and trying to fix it myself, that ain't going to be any good, because it's my brain that's doing the trickery. it's trying to measure things with a broken ruler. You can't, because the ruler's broken. You're by definition going to get a poor measurement. So that's kind of, you know, that was the, you can't fit all of that into a 3-minute pop song, especially if you're going to have a keyboard solo in the middle, you know. So it's a rather distilled version of that, really. It's just talking about London Bridge and kind of my change of heart when the kind of London Bridge-esque things happened later in life, and, you know, the change of direction I took.
With all due respect to mental health and not playing light on that, but like every now and then, it's just kind of fun to play into it, though. Like, I was thinking of like your interest in space and the universe, and we, you know, we have this, again, very scientific knowledge of that, but we also apply all of this magic, you know, knowing that maybe that's not part of it at all, but it sure is fun. I mean, how often do you just like give into it a little bit, though?
Well, I'm not somebody, unfortunately, that's kind of cursed by it from day to day on a long-term basis. You know, I've had several times in my life where it's been an issue, but these days it isn't an issue, so I don't have to worry about it. But yeah, there's no kind of, you know, the thing about psychology is it's science. The things that seem like magic to us usually seem like magic to us for quite a good reason. You know, magic itself, why, when we watch a magician, why do we go, wow, that's amazing, that's just so wonderful, rather than, well, there must be a string behind it yanking it up, mustn't there? Why is that our reaction? It's because, you know, of the way our psychology works. It's, again, it's something that's been quite well studied and it's very interesting. It explains a lot about why we are like we are. You know, why when we watch a play are we so willing to kind of buy into the conceit of the play? This takes place in a train carriage in 1846. I'm sorry, we're not in a train carriage in 1846. You know, that should be the ordinary reaction of those people. They're not original clothes. You're not even speaking in the right accent. You know, we don't do that. We all buy into it. We'll give of ourselves, and we'll suspend disbelief is the technical term, isn't it? Why are we so willing to do that? Why are we so willing to be suckered along by and it's to do with our love of story. It's to do with the way we remember things. It's to do with the way we process information. It says a lot about who we are and why we why we shape the world around us in a particular way. And it's actually quite interesting. So, you know, the dual nature of our perception of the world. There doesn't have to be any tension between the two. You know, they can coexist quite happily because of who we are, because of the way we're wired.
And we'll be right back right after this.
Borahe Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Welcome to the In Defense of Ska podcast.
There's a lot of like, okay, well, you like ska name three bands that aren't the Boss Tones.
I'm your host, Aaron Carnes, music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska.
And I'm your co-host, Adam Davis, veteran ska musician from the bands Omnigon and Link 80.
On our show, we aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of ska music.
There are so many great untold stories throughout the history of ska. The show features interviews with everyone from the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones to Fishbone, Fall Out Boy singer Patrick Stump, and the Police drummer Stuart Copeland. Join us on In Defense of Ska from the Consequence Podcast Network.
Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith with David Rowntree. Interesting segue there into a song like Machines Like Me, because I feel like it really does kind of blend. Like, what's going on in that song? Because, again, I think this is one of my other... I've got a lot of favorites on this album. It's going to, you know, depending on the day kind of a thing right here, but this is one of the one I've really kind of centered in on lately.
Yeah. Well, I used to tell, as you can tell, I like telling stories. Telling stories is a fun thing to do. And I used to tell this story about how, I really like machines. You know, I've always liked machines ever since I was a kid. There's something really interesting, really engaging with machines. And I was the kid in the 1980s that knew how to program the video recorder, you know, had read the manual. And, you know, all the kind of cryptic messages that they used to flash up when they were all 7-segment displays. I knew it all, you know. It's a segue from that, really, to kind of, well, have you ever seen those kind of apocalyptic films where the machines take over, you know, and the humans are driven underground and, are fighting for their very existence against these newly intelligent machines? And I used to say, because the machines and I get on quite well in that post-apocalyptic future, I'd probably be fine. You know, the machines would pop around, we'd have a cup of tea, you know, we'd have kind of a nice conversation. made jokes like that, I started to think, well, there's a grain of truth in that, you know. I really do like machines, and I really do feel like machines like me, you know. And if they do, what does that say about me? Is that a good thing, to be that kind of, have that kind of an affinity with an inanimate object? Isn't that actually a problematic personality trait rather than... You know, does that mean I'm less lovable as a result rather than more interesting at dinner parties? You know, so that was that kind of, it was that thought process really that was behind machines like me, just kind of me lying in bed dreaming about these things and kind of imagine, you know, it was that me having that conversation with myself that was the inspiration for that song.
And I don't mean this in an unfair way, but when I heard that song specifically,
well, don't say it then.
No. I mean
in an unfair way, but that song's shit.
No. I don't mean anything about the song. That'd be a fun part of this interview, wouldn't it? By the way, it's crap. Where do we go from here? No, I started thinking about Damon's album, Lonely Press Play, and how. I guess, you know, you all were probably just kind of dipping from the same well, which is understandable. You've known each other forever and you're probably doing it. But it gets to that point. Like, do you notice those moments? Do you try to stay away from, on a record like this, anything that has to be associated with Blur or whatever?
It wasn't a conscious process, really. What I tried to stay away from was being predictable. Though that turned out to be problematic in itself. I mean, how can you, it's a bit of a paradox, really. How can you be unpredictable if people know that, presumably, that's what I would try and do. So being unpredictable would be being predictable. So I wrapped myself up in knots on that one, really, until finally I thought, well, actually, what people are going to expect is some kind of drummy thing, some kind of rock thing, possibly. You know, some kind of something that maybe sounds a bit dry and worthy, maybe ranting about the Labour Party or something, you know. Well, that none of that interests me. So actually, it's going to be quite straightforward. What I really enjoy about music is a good tune. And, you know, all the songs I'd written had what I considered to be great tunes. So I thought, actually, let's just go with the flow and see where this goes. And that took a lot of the pressure off me, really. As I say, my studio doesn't have, I do own a guitar and there's some guitar on the record, but it's certainly not a guitar album. If anything, it's a synthesizer album, really, I guess. Synthesizer and found sound album, which makes it sound like the most boring album ever made, doesn't it, really? I don't think we shouldn't write that on the sticker on the sleeve, really. A synthesizer and found sound album with no drums. But it actually turned out to be fairly easy for it to be nothing like Blur. I didn't have to work at that at all. And I didn't need to worry anyway. To make a blur sounding album, you need four people, a specific four people at that. So, you know. Having just one of those doesn't mean you can make an album that sounds like Blur.
Well, you'll get that, I guess, back in your life again soon. And I hope you don't. I would love to ask just a couple things about that, because again, here you have this record, and then here you have the resurgence of this other big part of your life coming back, which a few of us have been waiting for a little while. Whose idea was this, and how did it get started, the reunion?
Yeah, I suppose it's 7 years since we last played together, so it probably is. You probably can call it a reunion now, can't you? But the idea came about because we were offered the chance to play Wembley Stadium, and that was some time ago, or the idea was floated that Wembley Stadium might be available. As I say, it was a few years ago now, and that the COVID pandemic intervened to make that actually seem rather unlikely. But because we're a band who have done most of what it's possible to do as a band, and about, you know, we don't really like to repeat ourselves particularly. It doesn't seem like you're moving forward if you're repeating yourself. So where possible, we sort of avoid that. So we're always looking for something new and interesting to do. And when somebody comes up with a new and interesting idea, that's when our kind of ears prick up and we start to consider it. And yeah, Wembley Stadium is one of the few sort of landmark venues really that we haven't played. You know, most of those venues that are on the album sleeves of your kind of hero bands growing up, you know, like Madison Square Garden and, you know, the Hollywood Bowl and those kind of things. We've done all of those, you know, Glastonbury, headlining Glastonbury. We've done that three times, you know. So I'm not going to gloating over that. I'm just saying, realistically, if somebody was to say, do you fancy headlining Glastonbury? Well, you know, we've done that. It's very, not saying we would turn it down, but it wouldn't be the kind of thing that would sort of tempt us out to start with, I don't think. I hope nobody from Glastonbury is listening though, because that's definitely interesting, just in case you are. It's still definitely interesting. But so yes, Wembley Stadium though was something we'd never done, and it hasn't been many, you know, it's been fairly recently that a gig of that size has been a feasible option for us. You know, we've never played anywhere that big before, you know, in a solo show. So and we weren't really sure whether that people would be that interested. It has been quite a while, you know, people have moved on. There are other bands now out there, apparently. I don't know who they are, but there are some other bands. So, it wasn't entirely clear that people were going to be interested enough to sell all the tickets for it. So, and anyway, as soon as the idea was mooted, it soon became impossible to do. And then when the pandemic receded, I don't think it's over yet, but when it receded, things started opening up again. There was this massive backlog of people wanting to go on tour, and there was a huge, enormous waiting list for all of these venues and for festivals. And it was just impossible to get on any bills. And Wembley is run as a football stadium, so football takes precedence. Again, it just didn't seem very likely there was going to be any more dates for where bands could play, and the whole thing just seemed like a nice idea, but incredibly unlikely to me. So, and I'm normally the glass half full kind of person, but anyway, so it's been on the back burner for years, to be honest, literally years. And, you know, the more the years rolled by, the more I thought, oh, well, you know, it's a nice idea, though. And then all of a sudden, everything came together. Suddenly a date was available and, like, frantic phone calls. Do you want to do it or not? Of course, I don't bloody want to do it. Well, I never said I didn't want to do it. So I thought it was unlikely. And
But for a gig to bring you out, and that's completely understandable, as you're saying, it's got to be something interesting to bring you out, but... But, you know, as you're saying, is it just, and I know what I'm eventually getting to the question here is, will there also be music? But could that have been the idea as well, that, you know, if somebody pokes out, whether, you know, Damon Graham or whoever, and says, hey, I got some songs. Like, is that part of how you all work as well?
Yeah, it could have been that. Yeah, somebody had an interesting idea. I mean, like the last album, that album, for example, you know, came about really by accident. We were in Hong Kong. We had a week off in Hong Kong. We all decided rather than go on holiday, we would make some music for a week. And, so, you know, we went in thinking, well, you know, what's the worst that could happen? If we don't get anything out of it, we'll have at least played our instrument, we'll, you know, have a bit of fun. And, you know, the end of the week, there, voila, there was this kind of album's worth of material. So, yeah, when we came back, you know, and probably about a couple of years later, it has to be said, but when we came back, we knocked it into some kind of shape. And, yeah, that was the thing that motivated us, you know. We were really proud of it, what we ended up doing, and that was the thing that motivated us to get out and play some shows. Yeah. So yeah, it does work the other way around as well.
Well, that's when you look at what it means to be in Blur in 2022, 2023, you know, like you hear about the gang mentality of when you start out. When you're young, you have the gang mentality and the band is the band. Of course, as you grow older, other things become a part of it. But how much of that is there? How much of the gang mentality still exists in Blur to make you all say, yes, let's make this new record?
Yeah, I mean, the once we're all together, you know, anything's possible. The making the music part of it has always been the easy bit. It's been the kind of everything around that that's been the difficult bit. So, yeah, as I say, once we're all back together, all bets are off. Who knows what's going to happen?
I mean, you're going to be rehearsing anyway. That's exactly. I expect.
Well, what normally we normally do something, and we're not making any promises, I'm not saying anything that people don't already know. We normally do write some new material, and the reason is this: our map, that we normally have a month in the rehearsal studios to rehearse. We normally need about a week, and then we end up with 3 weeks where we go, we don't want to carry on rehearsing, we're fine, you know, what should we do instead? And shall we go on holiday or shall we make some new music? Okay, let's make some new music is the way the thinking usually goes. So it wouldn't surprise me if that happened again. But as I say, that's just what normally happens. That's how various bits of music have arisen over the course of various tours. So if that were to happen again, it wouldn't surprise me.
Well, in the meantime, you get your hands full with Radio Songs, which again, Dave, is such a fantastic record. And I've cut some of the clips of you doing this live. I would love to see some of this live, and you don't have to wait for a Wembley date to do it. I mean, you're going to be touring on this for a bit as well, correct?
Yeah, well, I've got exactly one show in the diary now. I did three shows in the UK, really as a kind of dipping my toe in the water to see how and if it would work live, and it worked live very well. So I've got a show in East London on the at Rough Trade East on the day of release, which is 20th of January. Then I was musing on the idea of doing a festival tour in the summer, but some other project came along and snafu'd those festivals. So that probably won't be happening now. But yeah, definitely much of the point of this record really is to have something to tour when Blur aren't touring. Because waiting 7 years between your performances is too much for me. And, you know, playing live is the bit that makes all the other stuff worthwhile, really. That's the thing that I enjoy the most as a musician. So, yeah, the point of this is to tour. So, yes, over the next few years, I'm going to be touring this a lot.
1,000 miles. That's what you can put on the and beyond, I'm sure, on the
yeah, 1,000 miles. Yeah. If I only tour for 50 miles, will people ask for their money back? That's the question.
I'll be there to see it.
Yeah.
Dave, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about it. I love this album. I really do.
Thank you very much. Good to talk to you.
And my thanks to David Rowntree. The new album, the debut solo album, is called Radio Songs. Big thanks to you as well for checking out the episode. Again, please do hit that subscribe button so you can keep up with all the interviews that we put out every single week. It's a new one every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at iTunes and Apple Podcasts, at Spotify and Podchaser, NPR, WFPK.org, YouTube for the video versions, or again, anywhere you get your podcasts from. Subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. Then after that, head over to WFPK.org. It's where I do a show Monday through Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern, an hour full of song premieres and music news, anniversary spins, bonus interviews. That's Monday through Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern at WFPK.org. Consequence has your music and film news. You can also find me on the old social media spots, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all three of them. It's at Kyle Meredith. So do hope you like and follow along. That does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
There are some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a large unexpected inheritance. An always-on-the-verge-of-death phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone. Up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard so you can get a new one. Just trade in any phone from our top brands on any unlimited plan. With new line on my plan. Additional terms apply for trade-in and pay off your phone offer. See Verizon.com for details.
Consequence Podcast Network.
My reading of numbers leaves something to decide. I'm okay with the letters, but the numbers are really confusing.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.